Ukraine Calling.
4 years ago, 15-year-old Ukrainians read 1.5 academic years better than current kids in the ninth grade. We are losing the quality of human capital in a very, very swift manner.
How do we get them back?
I wish I had the answer. The entire generation of young Ukrainians, of primary school kids of first and fourth grades, who might have never been to school at all. By today, Russia has very deliberately targeted, destroyed or damaged severely every seventh school in our country. It's a very tricky question.
Hello, one and all. Welcome to Ukraine Calling. I'm your host, Brian Bonner, and we have an education rock star, superstar, and more in the studio today. Hanna Noasad, welcome.
Hi, Brian. What an intro.
Well, you are. I mean, a little background. You were one of the youngest ministers ever, I think, in independent Ukrainian history, one of the youngest. At 29, you took over as education minister, riding the wave of Zelensky popularity, servant of the people popularity. And I think what you've done since you stopped becoming the minister is as important or more. You've started a foundation called Save Ed.
Yeah.
Correct me if I got the figures wrong, but I think you've raised $10 million. You've worked in 70 communities in 5 regions, helping to restore access to education, especially on the front lines, where it's needed the most, to 60,000, maybe more, students.
Yeah, that's correct.
Digital learning centers, refurbishing damaged schools, so forth. This is really quite an achievement.
Thank you so much, and thank you for digging so deep into what we do and knowing the numbers.
Yeah. Well, I don't know all the numbers, and that's but that's why I have you here. But I just, you know, it's very impressive. You know, the sad thing is we are ending our second full academic year at war, and plus we had the partial one in the winter and spring of 2022. Can you give me the big picture of where we stand? And it's easier to measure damage to buildings, but maybe if you can give us the sense of where we are in online, offline, and how far behind some of these children have gotten.
That's indeed very important to talk about, not only the damaged infrastructure, even though numerically it is also unfortunately very impressive, because by today Russia has very deliberately targeted, destroyed or damaged severely every seventh school in our country.
Does that come to 1,000?
That's more than 1,500 schools. Before the big war, we had 14,000 schools, and now, However, these are buildings, right? And they do not necessarily tell a lot about how the quality suffered. But what matters is that it's indeed this September is going to be the third academic year during the full scale invasion, and then you also add 2 years of COVID, and so in total it's going to be 5 years of very heavily interrupted learning. And just to say, it's basically going to be the entire generation of young Ukrainians, of primary school kids of first and fourth grades, who might have never been to school at all, especially in the east, in the southern parts of Ukraine, all of those bordering Russia in the north, so Kyiv, Chernihiv regions. So the damage is pretty is pretty big. This academic year, September 23, started with almost 2 million Ukrainian school children out of 4 studying either completely online or in blended format.
Almost half.
Yeah, almost half. The situation improved a little bit until today. The ministry says that now, I just got from a call with the ministry, they say that now it's around 600,000 kids are doing online. So I'm not sure about blended. But, well, that figure dropped. However, it's still an extensive number of students just staying at home. And those who experienced COVID and had kids of school age or of preschool age know how horrible it is, because regardless of how good is your device,
right,
you will never substitute with online learning those skills, attitudes, values that you get only in an offline surrounding. So I'm now traveling a lot around the country, visiting all these frontline communities where we work at Safe Ed, and I meet a lot of kids, well, in the bomb shelters predominantly, and they are very... it's my subjective feeling, but a lot of them, those who stayed for basically more than 2 years of the big war online, they are very timid. They're very anxious. They are scared. They don't know how to communicate with you. Because they lack the skill, especially younger
social
kids.
Skills, yeah,
social skills are close to non-existent because they spend their time behind the screen. And I'm not talking even about the cases which are omnipresent when there is nothing at home in terms of equipment. So, but talking about also numbers, last year the whole world learned about the PISA results, and PISA is a big international study of education quality. Mm-hmm. It takes place every 4 years, so it's a cycle. Ukraine first took part in PISA 2019. So we introduced the report, the first report for Ukraine in December 2019. And the next 4 years basically were reported last October. The biggest change that we see, and the PISA measures a couple of competences. It measures, first of all, 15-year-olds, so those that are in the ninth grade. It measures reading skills, science, mathematics, and reading. And we see that the biggest drop in Ukrainian students within those 4 years is in reading. It dropped more than 1.5 academic years. So. Ooh. To put it in other words, 4 years ago, 15-year-old Ukrainians read 1.5 academic years better than current kids in the ninth grade. And this is not only about the ability just to physically read the book. No, it's not about that. It's about the ability to interpret the text. It's about the ability to understand what's the author's opinion, what are to distinguish facts from fiction, to understand the manipulation.
Critical thinking.
And that is, you know, how crucial that is for current Ukraine being in this in the war with Russia.
Go ahead. How did we do in the other measurements? I was going to ask. Are we falling behind?
All of them dropped. Oh. However, reading was is the worst, I'd say. However, there is also another dimension that that kind of appeared to be decreasing in a pretty fast mode. It's the gap between rural and urban areas. Well, you know, living in Ukraine, that rural areas in Ukraine are pretty impoverished. And it's not only a Ukrainian thing that rural areas have lower
all
quality
over the
education.
World, yeah.
In U.S., it's pretty much the same. However, it matters how big is this gap. And 4 years ago, when the first for Ukraine PISA took part, it was 2.5 years, academic years. In other words, a regular kid from a very regular, not private, not elitist school in Kyiv would be, learning 2.5 years faster than his peer in just a regular school in a village. And now, after only 9 months of war, because this is when the PISA results came out, this distinction is 4.5
the
years.
Gap.
Yeah, this gap is 4.5 years. And it is very, critical for us because, the huge number of schools are there in the rural areas. And this means that, we are losing the quality of human capital in a very, very swift manner.
Wow, that sounds, yes, like always, the poor rural areas that suffer the most, and they probably don't have the equipment or the safety, of course, that the cities have. How do we catch up? Is there a plan to catch them up? Because if hundreds of thousands or even millions of school children fall behind, it's going to hurt us as a nation.
Well, I cannot, of course, speak on behalf of the state, even though I admire efforts of the ministry and the current team to somehow fix the situation. However, I also don't envy them because the current ministerial team works in the worst possible circumstances and conditions during the entire regained independence time of Ukraine. They are short on money, they are short on other resources, there are challenges everywhere, they need to build bomb shelters, they need to, you know, somehow ensure security, they don't have funding for teacher salaries. So it's a lot of challenges. Yes. And on top of that is, of course, the need to deal with the learning loss. One thing to understand for everyone who kind of thinks about today's Ukraine in terms of how can we help is that different Ukrainian regions are in very different situations. So the way Lviv or Ternopil are now doing, including in education, is luckily much better than Kharkiv or Zaporizhia or Mykolaiv. But even we cannot compare.
Safer.
Yeah, it's safer. So kids go to offline learning. They can enjoy extracurricular activities when, of course, when there is no air raid. They can study above the ground, right? They do not have to sit in the bomb shelters only. However, you cannot also compare Kharkiv to Mykolaiv because Mykolaiv region, those liberated territories, including the city of Mykolaiv, they are now in much better situation than they've been a year and a half ago. So they are preparing towards reopening the schools for offline learning since as of next September. Okay. Whereas in Kharkiv region, you can only study on the ground. This okay. is your only possibility yes. if there is a safe, secure bomb shelter where you can, you know, comfortably learn and not die because there is no, you know, access to normal air or there is no ventilation and you just suffocate, you know. And this means that we have to have very different strategies towards different regions. Right. So there is like no one-size-fits-all policy available at all, including for catch-up learning. So that's why my position and my thinking is that there have to be very agile strategies. Of course, they all have to be coordinated by the ministry, who is doing what. However, every region and even parts of the region have to have a different kind of depth and level of attention towards that. The most critical thing right now is to try to resume as much offline interaction as possible. There is so-called coalition of devices, you know, procuring, getting laptops, tablets for kids. It's an admirable effort. However, it fixes just a very, very tiny little part of the right. problem. You know, a human needs a human. Right. And we cannot sit at home for, you know, like five or God knows how many years. So if we're talking, for instance, about Kharkiv region, the only possibility for them is to start building underground schools
yeah.
or capitally refurbishing the existing bomb shelters. If we are talking about liberated areas of Mykolaiv region or even Kyiv region, Kyiv region's recovery is not that great as many might think. There are still a lot of villages that are Russians destroyed, burned, exploded schools and kindergartens. But in here, in the Kyiv region, you can rebuild schools. You can put temporary solutions. You can put modular, right, to get kids back to learning. So I would say that answering your question in a shorter way, how to catch up on that, first of all, we have to resume at least some forms of offline learning. And in that sense, just to finish my thought, resuming access to education does not mean only rebuilding a school. There are other creative ways how to do that. And okay. and they are also very much dependent on the geographical factor.
That is a lot. And I should say, I missed in the introduction, Ukrainsky Pravda has named her one of the most, one of the 100 most powerful women, influential women in the country, deservedly so. But when I led the Kyiv Post, we named her top 30 under 30 winner.
Yeah.
In 2019. So we saw your talent.
Those good times when I was under 30.
believe me, yeah. I'll trade ages if you want sometime. But we wrote then, and these are unfortunately the good old days, we wrote that you face a daunting list of longstanding classroom issues, especially in village schools. Yeah. Textbook shortages, low salaries for teachers, poor facilities, outdated equipment, and more. And then we had COVID, and then we had the full-scale war. As we know, all of our money, I mean, if we have extra money, it generally goes to the armed forces because we need to win the war to win, to achieve all these goals. It is so heartbreaking because, you know, we had actually moved, and I had a former minister too, Sergei Fit, on the on the recent program, and we had talked about reforms that actually got moving in 2014. I wanted to ask you this strategy of bombing textbooks, Ukrainian textbooks, of bombing schools. Is this part of a genocidal campaign in your view?
Well, it's a very straightforward question. Of course it is, because I hope it is obvious to most of the people. And if it's not, then of course I will reiterate that Russia's goal is not to gain our territories. No, it's Russia's strategic aim is to make sure that we do not exist as a nation, as a state, as a political state, and as a ethnicity, and thus ethnical, religious, cleansing, stealing of our kids, converting them into, forcefully converting them, right? Brainwashing them and trying to convert them into...
In the occupied territories, or kidnapping.
Or kidnapping them and so-called retraining them in the camps.
Wiping the Ukrainians
out of exactly. Bombing the schools, burning the textbooks. This is all a part of that strategy. And unfortunately, Russians are very skilled and quite, well, I should say successful in that. You can see that when they occupy territories, for instance, what was happening in Kherson, in part of the Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk parts. After they occupy a territory, one of the first things that they do, they bring their teachers, right? They bring their teachers, they install their educational programs, they immediately bring Russian textbooks because they know, and they tested that throughout the centuries, that education is an important tool to brainwash and to keep, on the hook, on the ideological hook, the future generation. So, I've been to a lot of communities with completely bombed schools, and when my vis-a-vis in the dialogue said, like, well, hey, you understand that perhaps there were Ukrainian troops, but this argument does not really always hold, because Russians bomb schools not only in the front line, they bomb schools in Lviv, wherever they can. And there was one school in Katyushanka. Katyushanka, it's a small town in the Kyiv region. This is where it was occupied for 4 months during the start of the invasion, and Russian generals who were commanders of the Battle of Kyiv lived and stayed in that school, so it was kind of their headquarters. And the locals say that we work with that school at Save Ed, and the local teachers and kids say that they have taken down the pictures of Ukrainian poets, writers, historical figures that are usually on the walls of the school, and they put portraits of Lenin, for instance. And I'm like, what has to be in your head, right? While trying to invade the country and occupy it, you also bring portraits of Lenin to hang them in the school. It's like those little tiny things, they tell quite a lot. And Russians, of course, understand that we will never outnumber them. Numerically, we are losing. We are dying faster. We are ending faster on the front line. And the only thing we can do is the asymmetrical response. And that asymmetrical response in the long term involves good quality of human capital, intelligent people. And that's why in school.
Education has to be up number one as an investment, not just an expenditure. Strategy. I think I heard you say that, I mean, as many Ukrainians do, this war has been going on 400 years, actually.
Yes.
And there's no reason to believe that it's going to end anytime soon. Do we need a different strategy in education? And I'm thinking... I'm just trying to apply the lessons to the energy sector. And I heard DTEC CEO Max Timchenko to say, we repaired stuff last year and then it got bombed this year. What happens if we repair it again? Same could be said for schools, couldn't it? And while you've raised an impressive sum, I mean, government still, I mean, can spend, you know, billions and hundreds of billions compared to our charity efforts.
Yeah. Well, I think the it all comes down to the question, if we do not try to figure out the ways to resume access to services, what is our strategy? What do we tell people in the Kharkiv region if we do not help them with educational services? What do we tell them? Like, guys, you have to leave, all of you? Then where? Where do they go? You know, like, if we do not, if we do not help the communities to resume access to the services, and in this sense, I would call education as a service. It's all, it's of course a value. It's a kind of long ideological talk whether it's a service or welfare value, but still, it's now it's one of the critical services because people are choosing whether to return to their communities also based on the criteria whether there's school and schooling or kindergarten available, right? So to me, it it all comes down to that. If we want people to stay there and it's
and come back
and come back, if it is still livable there, we have to ensure that they have these services. I'm not an energy expert. I have little understanding whether it is possible to, in the long term, to replace all our big old energy plants with more decentralized, smaller, portable energy kind of stations. However, in education sector, it's something, it's a temporary strategy that we have to apply. In Kharkiv region, well, even though Russians bombed more than 50% of the schools in the Kharkiv region. However, even if they were intact, you can still not attend them because it's not safe. It takes like 40 seconds, 2 minutes for a missile to reach. What do you have to
30
do?
30 seconds.
Yeah, you have to study underground. So that means the basements have to be converted into temporary schools. And it's not, it does not equal for school, but it's still better than nothing. Like 5 hours of electricity in Kyiv is still better than nothing, right? So to me, the strategy is, well, at least it, the interim strategy is like that. If people live there, if there is no forced evacuation, we have to make sure that they have access to the services. If they have to be bused to a different community, or for instance, kids of upper secondary school, of those that are more mature, if they can be bused and live for a week somewhere in a boarding school and thus have access to learning, we have to ensure that. So we are in a situation when a traditional approach to schooling does not work. And this access has to be has to happen in a very creative way, I'd say.
Especially because I wanted to ask you about the refugee situation. And we've done studies, or I haven't done studies, but studies have been done showing the longer the war goes on, the fewer people will come back. As we know, most of the people abroad are women of childbearing age, I guess, with children. How do we get them back?
I wish I had the answer. I think the answer is that first the war has to end, and there has to be you know, security guarantees and safety in Ukraine. That's not apparently happening in the nearest perspective. I'd probably start from a different angle. I oftentimes think about this, and probably regretfully, maybe I will disappoint you with my answer, but I think we have to, in this situation now, we have to think, whom do we help first? Because the resources are limited, attention of state organizations, civil society, international partners is limited. So whom do you help first? In my view, these should be those that are most vulnerable and those that need much more attention now. And to me, these are those kids that stay in Ukraine, especially in east, south, bordering communities with Russia and Belarus.
It makes sense, yes.
And this is where our kind of biggest effort has to be. Because if we kind of put it as an angle right now to return all or at least a part of our kids and their families who stay abroad, I'm not sure we can at this very moment influence those factors that make their decision, right? Regretfully, I think that we have to start thinking about the strategies. How do we as a country, state institutions have to think about that. And us as civil society, as foundations like ours, we have to think what are the programs to work with our, well, let's be honest, emerging diaspora. I don't think that we will ever be able to beat those favorable conditions that are there, that we will ever be able, in the coming decades, right? How do we make sure that they have the same good quality of higher education as they will have there? These are like the true picture of the situation. However, it doesn't mean that we have to forget about them. Okay. There have to be programs, there have to be actions. How do we involve them and include them in recovery of Ukraine? This could be scholarship programs with Ukrainian universities and European or other universities where Ukrainians stay. And this could be something like Peace Corps, right? But for Ukrainians staying abroad, helping during the summer, during the year, whatever, helping communities in Ukraine to recover. You know, I think we have to look for this ways to at least partially engage them. I'm talking, of course, mostly about young people, kids, students.
It's a mixed bag. A lot of people, and I more than I do, but it's, you know, some will come back after the war. Others, their kids already in the third year of German school, and they have friends and they speak the language and
currently
they have a job.
We are talking about 500,000 Ukrainian kids of school age staying abroad. This is an astonishing number. For me, it's very hard to reckon how many of those we will ever be able to return. But then again,
which is also part of Putin's strategy,
exactly,
to destroy the nation.
But I think the worst thing that we can do is to blame these people, is to victimize them, is to cut any ties with them just because they did this choice. I would urge not to equal that to men,
right,
who left and did that choice. I think it's a completely different ethical issue. But when we're talking about the kids and the choice of their families, encompassing all different stakeholders and players, we have to show that we are welcoming to different efforts of theirs to be helpful to Ukraine, including actively engaging them to advocacy. You know, just a bit off topic. If you might recall, there was a huge uproar in Ukrainian Facebook, which was in Ukraine still very, very popular, at least among, millennial generation, when the U.S. was helping to, the U.S. and allies was helping to take down missiles and drones over Israel.
Right.
But it didn't help the same way to Ukraine. This is just a tiny fraction of the answer. However, State of Israel spent how many? More than 60 years lobbying, advocating on the Hill, working with, congressmen, working in D.C. heavily, working with its diaspora in the United States to push for support as the State of Israel has, right? It's just a part, of course, just a part of that. And but if we are in a situation when we have a growing diaspora, why don't we work, we as those who live, stay here in Ukraine and the state, why don't we work towards engaging them in what is needed for advocacy efforts?
Exactly. So we're starting to see some of that.
Yeah,
I think.
Absolutely.
And because I know you've spent a lot of time in my country, America, my other country. Well, you know a lot more teachers than I do, and but I have experience with the public school system here, and they are saints because they work they work very hard and they're very devoted for not much pay, as we know, sort of like journalists. But I digress. But anyway, I wanted to mention you lost a very good friend, Borodanka. Yeah. You were going to go into the education business with him.
Yeah.
Right?
So when I resigned in 2020, it was pretty hard time figuring out what to do next. One of the kind of ideas that was always somehow with me is to do my own school, and private education is allowed in Ukraine. It's quite popular. It was on the rise before the big war, private schooling, private kindergartens. And so I was looking into kind of playing and working with an idea to open up an up secondary school, a lyceum, a private one. And actually, when I was in the U.S. on the fellowship, I was devoting a lot of my time towards that, researching, discovering, learning from the American models of high schools, because those in the U.S. are, in a lot of cases, pretty good. And I had a colleague, his name was Mark Bobrovsky. He was the deputy principal of one of the schools here in Kyiv. Very progressive, modern educator. Brilliant personality. He had a bad luck of living in Borodyanka, and he refused to leave. I remember we spoke last time with a team on Zoom on 21st of February when everyone was evacuating from Kyiv. I was doing that, and he said, like, I won't leave. Who needs Borodyanka? You know, back then, any tiny, settlement around Kyiv, you know, you cannot imagine that carpet bombing can happen over it. It's just now
people went to Bucha and Irpin escape for a peaceful life.
Exactly. Now it all seems like, hey, you should have thought about it. But back then it was,
a good friend of yours. And
yes, John. And he was in that house that was bombed by the Russian aviation, and we managed to recover his body under the debris only in early April, I think mid-April, when the Ukrainian armed forces regained our Kyiv and Chernihiv region, and basically the occupation started.
Traumatic. The trauma runs pretty deep in this nation
that's true.
Unfortunately, I wanted to ask you whether you still felt this way. One of your successors came under your criticism, and you had said in an article that Shmihal's education is his last priority. One of the education ministers, well, he was a bit of a apologist for Yanukovych, I believe.
Yes.
Do you still feel that way about the government?
It's a very tricky question. on the one hand, there is this, there has been this self-imposed censorship. It was very omnipresent among the journalists, but also, I think, in general, in the society.
We all want to win the war.
However, I think that it's very important to call things as they are. Of course, things changed dramatically since 24th of February 22, and what was a point of criticism before that and now are very different things. First of all, there is a completely different team in place in the Ministry of Education. Oksan Sovy, the minister. I admire him a lot. He volunteered as a soldier when the war started, so he spent more than a year on the front line in Donetsk and Kharkiv regions, and I had an honor to ask and beg and advocate for his yes to at least go for an interview as a Minister of Education. I remember I called him. Well, I knew that the governmental team is looking for a new minister, and he was one of the candidates that was on the table, and I called him. He was in Kremina, and it was around 10 p.m. and he was around Starlink, so he could talk, and I asked him, Oksan, like, if not for you, I don't think that there is anyone else currently who is decent and professional enough, and who can, on the other hand, be approved by the president? Because right. it's also an important thing to take into account, whether a person is, what's the English word, I don't know, like passable
right.
in the office of the president. He agreed to take on this mission. The current, it was very hard to compose the team. Unfortunately, civil service in Ukraine had a huge blow towards it. We are in a very difficult, complicated political system. The decision-making process is very opaque. It's there is not really clear division of responsibilities. So all things considered, it was very hard to assemble a team. You find people who would basically volunteer to go for civil service and be blamed and be hated and work for, you know, basically serve.
It's a thankless task.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. So,
but a necessary task.
So I by no means criticize them now. I think
they're more to your liking than
they. It's not just about my subjective liking. Like I judge people by what they do.
Right.
Yeah, and they do necessary things. However. For them, you know, if someone is expecting that in some miraculous way, it's during the wartime, it's possible also to reform the education system, this person should be either naive or stupid. To me, it would be a miracle if we even manage to preserve a status quo.
So set that aside, our great reform ambitions for now.
Well, unfortunately. Yeah. Unfortunately, because your resources, your time, your attention, your money goes towards ensuring the basic needs like teacher salaries. You know, during the first year of war and a little bit more, teacher salaries have been paid by the World Bank. You know, current subventions for bomb shelters right. will also be refunded by the World Bank. So we are, well, not completely, but to a huge degree dependent on the international institutions' financial assistance in education. And people just don't know that. So, this is what I'm saying. Like, even ensuring status quo, even trying to hold it, is a big victory in this circumstance.
Is that the way teacher salaries work now? They're being reimbursed by
I think partially.
Partially.
I think partially the macro financial support that we receive goes towards.
We really need our partners. Okay.
Well, that's
for sure.
That's for sure.
I haven't seen We Are You. Your documentary, which you screened all over America and other places, I think. Where do people watch it if they want to watch it?
Well, just a few words about what it is.
Right.
We at Save Ed, we fundraise a lot. We work with recovery of access to education in different formats. So we have like a lot of infrastructural work, a lot of soft educational programs. But one of our streams of work is advocacy and telling the outer world like what's happening in Ukraine in the education sector, how deliberate and conscious is Russia in destroying our access to educational services, how it is part of this bigger strategy of Russia to eliminate us as a nation. And so we basically just experiment with different ways to deliver that message, in a situation when the world is bored.
Attention span.
Yeah, you have to, well, you are in the war, but you also have to entertain the foreigners, right. You know, with the circumstances that you live in. So this year, last year we've been to the US, we presented our research about the first year of war in education, and this year we did the same. We did a big research with the European Commission support on that. However, along that, we did a documentary about five Ukrainian teenagers from different war-damaged regions, Kharkiv, Zaporizhia, occupied Novakhovka, and other, telling their stories, like how do they live in these circumstances. And the idea was not to talk from the point of view of drama and tragedy and being, you know, whiny and begging for help, no, but kind of telling our story from the situation, from point of strengths, from the point of resilience, and also showing to their peers, American peers, European peers, that they are the same. They are pretty much the same kids who have similar dreams, who work on similar super progressive projects, who can be enrolled in the best world-class universities, but now they have to deal with this, you know. So, and our kind of idea was to show this documentary, it's a short one, it's just 50 minutes, to show it to American, first of all, American peers. So we did a screening around a lot of high schools in the United States with a thought that, you know, this is a, in the future, it's a generation of American citizens who will
understand,
well, understand, who will make decisions, who will vote, you know, they have to have some kind of understanding what are their peers going through in Ukraine. And coming back to your question,
was it well received in your tours?
Yes, we did quite a lot of screenings. It did the job. We had a lot of screenings in the high schools, in the universities, and we plan to continue doing so. Just in a week and a half, we are going to Lithuania to do a screening. Then we have France, Norway, Estonia, and Finland, Germany. So
those of us here can watch it.
It was on Suspilne recently. It was. But we also plan to have another screening, to have a new series of screening closer to the new academic year when there will be more attention
It's not going to be on YouTube.
It will be on YouTube. It will be. Eventually. It will be. Yeah.
I'll look forward to seeing it. Sounds great. That was a Save Ed project.
Right? Yes, that was the Save Ed project that we did with Skin on Art Only production. Yeah.
Listen, you know, this is a great discussion, and I'd ask a lot of questions, but maybe I should cede the floor to you for issues that we haven't talked about. But I know I've read you're not going to do this forever. Oh. Save Ed. And so I'm just wondering, to the extent that anybody can plan during a full-scale war, what's your short-range plan?
My short-range plan is to continue developing the organization. We are quite young. We are less than two years old. So basically, this is the... now is the time when we are, what's the English phrase? We reap the results, of what we saw last year, because arranging the big bomb shelters, rebuilding schools, providing catch-up program, it takes time. So basically now we are on a full swing of the realization of the closure and realization of new projects.
Well, your profile is building.
Yeah, our profile is building. We have a lot of work, a lot of partners coming. We will start soon a big project with LIGO Foundation in Mykolaiv, doing more and more bomb shelters, basically underground schools. So to me, like, institutionalizing Safe Ed is priority number one. In the kind of 10 years perspective, I would see us working also internationally. You know, this time of the full-scale invasion for a lot of Ukrainians was also a time to learn how international organizations and international NGOs work. And it's rather an exception that they work well.
Right.
We see a lot of cases of complete lack of professionalism, understanding,
cluelessness.
how do you help a particular country with its particular context, not applying the solutions that you applied in Afghanistan, just because here it's different from so many different angles. A lot of things like that. And so watching how others work, how international big players work, those that were in the field and on the market, let's put it like that, for quite a long time, makes me kind of makes me thinking, why can we do the same but with a much better approach, with completely different attitude, with solutions that are fit the context. Well, basically, long story short, I would see Safe Ed internationalizing, and in that sense also bringing subjectivity to Ukrainian organizations in the international fora. I'm just fed up of people thinking about us as, money beggars who can only...
There's a lot of catch up that needs to be done there. That's unfortunately for sure. And I realize that every time I step out of this country, I feel like I'm in a bubble here, but I think that
people should know obvious things that they don't know about Ukraine. But anyway, that's another story. We're recording this just before you go to the recovery conference. What do you hope to achieve there? Or why are you going?
Well, to me, honestly, Berlin Recovery Conference, it's more of a networking opportunity. Right. I'm always looking for partners because my biggest aim or task, I'd say that, is
hunting
fundraising,
for money.
Fundraising, engaging partners, right, and making, not even like hunting for money, but also trying to persuade players like European Commission. What exactly you have to do in Ukraine in order to regain access to education? Because it's not obvious for people who don't live here, who don't work here.
True.
So a bit of shaping of international assistance is something that, I do, and I think I assume that might happen along the lines of that conference.
Well, I wish you luck. I know whatever you're going to do, you know, it's going to be for Ukraine, and we're lucky for it. So. Maybe this is a good point to leave it here.
Sure.
Hanna Novosad, I thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian,
for joining me in the program. Remember her name, because she's going to be a star for many decades to come. And I'm so glad you found the time to talk with us today. And that's it for this week's Ukraine Calling. I'm Brian Bonner. We'll see you again next week.